Welcome to Straight Talk on Health with Dr. Vincent Medici. Knowing that ultimately it's God who does the healing, Dr. Medici acts as the maestro, orchestrating a person's health through right timing and right therapies, using traditional, natural, alternative, and spiritual practices. Dr. Medici says it's time for people to wake up to their innate potential to heal and to be given a doctor who can orchestrate that healing. Dr. Medici is currently working toward his PhD in biochemistry at Long Beach University, with additional study in acupuncture, kinesiology, and quantum medicine. He's the curriculum director of the Santa Monica Shiatsu School and the clinic director at the Premier Center in Santa Monica, where he treats many famous names in Hollywood under nationally recognized Premier Labs owner and CEO Dr. Robert Marshall. Got a health question? Ask Dr. Medici live today on Straight Talk on Health. And now, here's Dr. Medici.
Good morning. This is the show I've been wanting to do for quite a while. It's a subject that's close to my heart, and I'm sure many of you are going to relate to this ridiculous diagnosis circulating in the medical community today, a diagnosis of default, a diagnosis of exclusion, and one that's, I think, destroying our educational system. It's called attention deficit disorder. It's called, Mrs. Smith, your child is bipolar, manic depressive. You have to understand the evolution of these statements and what they represent in the psychoanalytic community to really understand why you need a different perspective so you don't, in my own words, drink the Kool-Aid. Drink the Kool-Aid. That means to swallow the lie. Most of the time, there's absolutely nothing wrong with your child. And as a mother, as a grandmother, as a parent, as a whatever, when you in your heart and soul feel that that child of yours is gifted, yes, I'm talking about those gifted kids that get these diagnoses in school because they can't sit still, because they have behavioral patterns that really, really aren't compliant with what the educational community called standard. And the first place you're going to look when you hear from this show on that your child has a deficit disorder, especially an attention deficit disorder or a bipolar disorder. Bipolar means what? They split off into another part of themselves that doesn't relate to the classroom. Let me give you a hint on this one. They're bored. I'm going to repeat that. They're bored. Many, 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 many times, attention deficit disorder in a child is nothing more than the child is bored in school. And we've all been bored in school, more or less. And we all remember those shellackings we'd get if we went home and told our parents to do our homework because we were bored. And often it's nothing more than that. Now, that's a profound statement from my perspective, but you see, we've evolved a society today that has to understand things only from the complex point of view. Common sense really doesn't play a role. And I remind you, 50, 60 years ago, my favorite analogy, in the 60s when cigarettes, the current notion was that cigarettes were not anything that you should care about because it wasn't going to harm your body. And those very same cigarettes 30 years later were at the top of the list for the no-no. And what was that? That was people for years in their hearts with their common sense applied, knowing that there was a problem with cigarette smoke. And if you study the evolution of medicine, you see it's filled with moments like this. So I'm going to talk today about the spiritually gifted child. Spiritually gifted. The child who shows a special type of intelligence that's somehow acting in the classroom. I get moms in the office all the time. I know my kid is gifted, but they've been labeled. And once they're labeled, the disease begins. Before they're labeled, especially if you, the parent, stick by your child. You're going to find that your child has perhaps yet undiscovered talents that just don't jive inside society today, especially a classroom. Because it's not just the classroom. It's society in general. People come into the world with very sensitive nervous systems. Very sensitive nervous systems. What does that mean? It means if a child functions on multiple tracks, it means if they walk into a classroom and they can figure out the teacher's personal life by looking at the teacher. If they can't describe it, it's still affecting their neurological system. If they've got other levels of perception that many of the other children can't relate to and aren't gifted with, it can interfere with that child's learning. Learning a subject is very singular. And unfortunately, they are simply memory tasks. So what about the child that's working on multiple tracks? What about the child that can see underneath the surface of the teacher or other children or so on and so forth, that's being presented with what appears to be a simple task, but its focus isn't on that task because there are more interesting things, better truths to be explored and understood, the stuff between the lines. So some kids can see between the lines. Some kids can understand underneath. That's a perceptive depth quality. And if that's your child, your child's going to get bored in school. Now, to understand why they're labeled, you got to understand the history of analysis in the United States. It started with Freud. And Freud had an interesting story. Freud was a neurologist, and a woman walked in that couldn't move her arm. And Freud, being a neurologist, did the workup on the woman and found that no matter what he applied neurologically as a neurologist, somewhere in the 1880s or so, he couldn't provide a solution, as did the other doctors. Intuitively, and with all his creative intelligence, Freud ended up talking, creating verbal dialogue with the woman, and getting her hand to move. Normally, the woman returned to normal function. And Freud looked at it and said, there's something going on that has to do with relationship. And that was the birth of psychotherapy. Now, from that, Freud developed a very interesting reality. He looked at the child as a product of what it experiences in the first year of its life, calling that the oral stage, where the child develops its psyche in relationship to the mother's breast, where it learns to gratify itself in breastfeeding. And if that was finessed correctly, if the child was satisfied, if it had its basic level of comfort evolved during that phase, it went on to a second anal stage where the child learned the normal defecation reflex. And around these things, you have many, many potentials for mishap. If the child isn't breastfed, if the breast is pulled away, if it's not breastfed long enough, so on and so forth, you've got many developmental issues to deal with later on. The anal stage, the same thing. If the child does not learn the pleasure through the defecation reflex because the mother isn't there, or there's some anomaly in that process for whatever reason, the child does not learn pleasure through its body. And that pleasure, in the ideal of how Freud saw it, culminated in the relationship with the mother, where through the Oedipal stage, the third stage, the child goes into what's sometimes a very difficult moment for the father, where the child goes into a world between itself and the mother where they reflect to each other their mutual beauty. And that's that bonding stage with the mother that mothers understand so well, where it's just you and your baby and you're in this state of bliss. And very often dad is on the outside. And then he'll get his time. He'll come his way. But in the beginning, it's that baby and the mommy and the bliss they see in each other's eyes. And as that child is satisfied through this process, there comes a point, and every mom remembers that point, where there's this moment where that child begins to develop its sense of self. That it wants what it wants. The I of the child develops. We call this the ego. And as the ego develops, the child begins to separate from the mother. And this can mean so many important moments. But if that moment where the child then separates from the mother during the Oedipal stage, if that's finessed correctly, then that child starts to transfer the vibration it develops with the mother. And that vibration is transferred out into the world. Now, the bliss behind that process, the bliss behind being breastfed, the bliss behind learning the pleasure of the defecation reflex, the bliss behind the evolution with a mother, where it looks into the mother's eyes and it feels central to all of existence. When that bliss begins to transfer out into the world, and the mother doesn't covet it, and the mother lets it go, my child's growing up, the mother says. You got it down. That first 6 or 7 years, from the oral to the anal to the Oedipal to the post-Oedipal stage, determine the child. Now, all the mishaps along the way, where the child's breastfed incorrectly, not long enough, where the baby bites the nipple and the mother pulls away, the mother doesn't have any milk for this one, so on and so forth. All the way to the mother coveting the child, where the child should pull away from the relationship, and yet the mother, and this may be in her own subconscious, covets the child, refuses to let the child grow up. All these varieties of mishaps laid the foundation for psychoanalysis. And so you would come in and sit down and be analyzed by your shrink. And that's the way it began. Then a man named Wilhelm Reich, came in the 1920s. He was a student of Freud's, and he had a fundamentally riveting perception. And that perception was is that all these errors that could occur created a defense, an armor, a neurotic character, exterior to what the child really was. That it's the expression of its soul, its creative force was blocked. And that blockage occurred not just in the psyche, but it occurred in the body itself. So to Freud, Reich added the word body armor. Freud created a sense of how to let the creative passion of the child flow. And all the mishaps along the way was what basic early psychoanalysis consisted of. Reich came along and said, this blockage now is not just in the psyche, it's in the body itself, and you have to address it in the body. And then Carl Jung came along, and he gave his slant on it, with much association as Freud had to the dream. All this is going to lead to attention deficit disorder. All this is going to lead to Prozac. All this is going to lead to Zoloft, Wellbutrin, Ativan. All this is going to lead to the millions of dollars spent each year trying to cultivate your psyche. It began with a woman who couldn't move her hand and a man, Sigmund Freud, who cured it completely. And in the old days, whether it was Freudian psychology, Reichian emotional therapy, going into the body to take out the psyche, or Jung, where the dream analysis took on a special slant, whether it was Freud or Reich or Jung, right up into the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, if you were educated, if you understood the psychoanalytic movement, if you had problems, psychologically based problems, you would see a psychiatrist. And that psychiatrist would put you on the couch and you would talk and you'd develop relationship. This is a very avant thing. Many, many, many educated people do this. And this wave swept from Europe to America and it became its own residency in medical school. You didn't become a psychiatrist in the 1920s. And if you did, psychiatry was more or less for people who were truly and deeply insane. And most of those people ended up in sanitariums, homes, etc., etc. But you see, with Freud came this perception then that your everyday person has a certain amount of neurosis, a certain amount of misguided behavioral pattern. And thus you'd see your psychoanalyst. Now, this is the way it worked. All the way into the 1950s, where you'd pay by the hour on the couch hours and hours and hours. Now, competing with this, and this is my point, competing with this perception of psychoanalysis was a man named Robert Assagioli. Assagioli developed a perception of psychoanalysis called psychosynthesis. You want to get this. If you've ever seen your psychologist, your psychiatrist, if as a mom you feel your child's being labeled, you have this one. And then we have these books that, like I have here on my desk, the ICD code for psychoanalytic diagnoses. Hundreds and hundreds of diagnoses that are sent into insurance companies for reimbursement. And your child fits one of those. You fit one of those descriptions, and on that basis, here's the Prozac, here's the Zoloft, so on and so forth. The evolution of this didn't include any of these pharmaceuticals. The evolution of this did include labeling people with problems that may have been from a more exalted perspective. Meaning, Assagioli came in, a psychiatrist, a medical doctor like Freud, and said, wait a minute, there's a mistake being made here. And this is the point. So bear with me, but this is the point now. Assagioli disagreed, and his model of growth psychology said that psychoanalysis and psychology focused on the basement of human nature. The low part of it, and tended to reduce authentic spiritual yearnings to neurotic infantile impulses. Assagioli came in and said to Freud, which is to say to your psychologist when they tell you you have a panic disorder, anxiety disorder, attention disorder, bipolar disorder, manic depressive disorder. Assagioli, as early as the 20s, via psychosynthesis, came in and said, no, you're not functioning because you're neurotic. You're functioning because the world is reducing your authentic spiritual and creative abilities. It's reducing them to neurotic infantile impulses. Now, this was really confrontive to Freud. This is a completely different perception of how to deal with someone. And let's take your child. Your child sits in class. It starts cutting up. The teacher disciplines it. And sooner or later, the parent is called in and made aware of something that may have started in the house already, that the child is just a problem. And we look for answers. Where's the perspective that says, Mrs. Smith, your child has powerful, creative, and spiritual abilities? Your child is seeing between the lines. But the academic system or the world in general is asking your child to not see between the lines, to not use great creative and or spiritual abilities. And therefore, your child has attention deficit disorder, bipolar disorder. And when your child gets depressed after it's been elated, in other words, when your child feels its bliss, the bliss it's transferring from the mother into the creative world as it explores its talents and it feels like it's unabated, that it's not blocked, that nothing's in its way, and it goes high or manic, as we say, to find out that it has its power taken away in the classroom because its ability to read between the lines is denied and it gets depressed. Something rains on its parade, and because it's so powerful, it has a particularly catastrophic effect on its behavioral pattern. We call that child manic depressive. At least in the 50s, the 40s, and somewhat in the 60s, we gave that child an opportunity to sit with somebody, a trained professional, and work out the issues. At least we did that. We labeled it, and that was a drastic error, as Asala G. Oli points out. But at least we gave it a chance to talk. Today, we've taken it monster. And to show you just how insidious this problem is, I'm going to tell you a little story in a moment. But this problem is now we medicate. Now we medicate the child. We don't even know the long-term effect of these things. And yes, I understand when behavioral patterns become absolutely untenable, when kids may harm themselves, when people may harm themselves. Yes, pharmaceutical drugs. If anybody's ever been there, I've been close with patients many, many times. And there's use for them. There's always a balanced perspective that has the most power. But just to write off what might be an extraordinarily gifted person or gifted child that doesn't fit in correctly and give it some hacky label and then medicate it so that it just moves paralytically through the rest of its life is a sin. That is a misuse of science. And at least we used to sit on the couch and do analysis. Now we've simply moved into 10 minutes of analysis or 5 minutes of a chit-chat, and the psychiatrist writes a prescription. It's a psychology, and this is a shift in psychology. So you have to understand the medical evolution here. The psychologist, after the 50s and 60s, the psychologist, not a medical doctor, the psychologist, PhD clinical psych, MFCC, all sorts of psychology degrees, not psychiatry, took over the role of the psychiatrist. So the MD prescribed the drugs after the 60s, and then the PhDs did the verbal counseling. And what happened? See, what happened is that the psychologist got tied into the system. And the system says to the psychologist, if you don't take part in the overall plan, we won't reimburse you for the little bit of psychoanalysis that you might do. So the game has become, okay, we'll try 5 or 10 sessions, and now the insurance is burned out. They won't reimburse anymore. And so now we're going to just recommend that you drink the Kool-Aid. You go on the Prozac, the Wellbutrin, the Ativan, the Zoloft, so on and so forth. A new one invented every day. So this transfer from Freud to the couch, from the couch to writing drugs, psychologist picking up the rest of it, and now the psychologist seduced by the system so that it gives you a minor in talk therapy, and then you're off back to the shrink to get the pharmaceutical diagnosed, the prescription written, all one tight system now. And you know what it's doing? Every single year, the numbers increase. The number of people on antidepressants, anti-anxiety is skyrocketing. And it all started with a man named Freud who talked a woman out of paralysis because the mind can influence the body. We learned that. Where did that perception go? It started with Reich, who said, now go into the physical body to remove the neurosis. It started with Asagi Oli, who said, be careful when you do analysis that you don't label your patient. You just might be taking genius or that spark of genius or that spark of brilliance and destroying it by labeling it. Feed its genius. Now there's you, the mother, with the gifted child. Well, there's you out there on your meds, knowing underneath it all that you have these gifts. And yet you doubt yourself. You doubt yourself because the whole norm of society, like a bunch of blind, is following these models that are dead and useless. And the proof is in the statistics, my friends. The statistics bear out what I'm saying. How could such an increasing percentage of American society, of world society, need to be medicated? That's insight. That's spiritual elevation. That's an upgrade in our consciousness as a species. And yet it's happening everywhere. I'm not making this up. I'm simply reflecting back to you what I see in the streets every day. So number one, get the history of this down. And understand that from Assagioli to all the transpersonal psychologists, transpersonal psychology, they said effectively, it's your genius that's not being fed. It's your potential that's not being fed. That very high, unique, special niche that you're supposed to occupy, that's one hair, that's one eyelash shy of genius, is not being fed, and that is why you fail. And in our ignorance, then, we label you and we drug you. That's the death of a nation. You were brought into this world unique. And you were brought into this world sometimes to suffer a bit. But to suffer and overcome that suffering is what potentiates your brilliance. And when people in the white coats with degrees step in and tell you, you've suffered and now you've been damaged, and because you've been damaged, now we give you a label, and to make things good for you so you don't have to feel bad, we kill your feelings and now you don't feel anything. You know, it's interesting. Remember in the 20s, the Brave New World, Aldous Huxley? Do we still read that one in school today? Do we still do that? Huxley's daughter was Laura Huxley. Laura Huxley was a student of Assagioli. She wrote a book on Assagioli's work. Very interesting that her famous dad, Aldous Huxley, Doors of Perception, Brave New World, prophetic in its time and coming to true today, should team up with Assagioli. Don't numb the feelings. Understand that your pain can come from that spark of creative brilliance within yourself. Feed that. Cultivate that. Now, how do you cultivate that? Number one, you get off carbs. Yeah, it's coming down to the basics. You want to know what to do? It's in 35 shows. Get healthy. Number one, if your kid's got attention ADD, I'll call it, if it's bipolar, if it's manic depressive, get it off the carbohydrate and feed that kid fat. Because fat is brain fuel. Raw fat is brain fuel. Coconuts, olives, avocados, the nuts, the oils from fishes. Fat is brain food. You should be making your glucose from fat, not carbs. There's number one. Any amount of money, any dollar, $1 of mine to $100 of yours. Excuse me, $100 of mine to one of yours. I will bet you that if you get your kid off carbs and feed it raw fats, and let it go through that transition so it can have energy, carbohydrate, you will watch your child sedate. Hyperactive kids with hyperactive minds burn fuel faster. That's not rocket science to understand that. Hyperactive kids with hyperactive minds burn fuel faster. And if you burn the brain faster, if you burn the nervous system faster, what does the nervous system utilize to repair itself? Perhaps at a, relatively speaking, much higher rate than the kid sitting next to you in school. It burns fat. You need fat to repair the nervous system. So how many kids with ADT, ADD, bipolar disorder, manic depressive, are sugar junkies? And sugar's a neurotoxin. Sugar's garbage food. Sugar gives you that high. the wrong kind of high. It's the drug high. Sugar's a bad drug. Carbs are bad drugs. If you've got a kid with Diadamo, eat right for your blood type. Not into that. Don't say Medici said, eat right for your blood type. Take the essence of a teaching that John Diadamo labored hard and threw into the health pot. That's bloods don't metabolize carbs well. Their insulin spike is ridiculous. They're not made for carbs. Especially if you're old blood and you're a sugar junkie and your kid, he's just a kid. He's just a typical American kid. And what am I going to do? Because all the kids are sugar junkies. And then you put your kid on drugs for ADD, or you drink the Kool-Aid because it's bipolar, or it starts showing signs of early mania and then depressive phases, and your kid's on sugar and you didn't pull it off carbs, but rice is okay. No, you got to get that one straight. Number one, especially with an old blood kid, and I'll elaborate in a moment, get your kid off carbs. Feed its brain with fat. When it's hungry, when its blood sugar drops, when it's getting weak and it can suck down an oxygen, when it can have a coconut shake, when it can take raw butter and mix it with an egg, and mix that egg with a salsa or an avocado or some raw fermented cheese. And it can balance its blood sugar so it runs out of the house with energy and it doesn't have low blood sugar. Your child will have energy and be sedated. So number one, you start there. But before number one, understand that your kid may be that super gifted kid. And those super gifted kids need a lot more than just good nutrition, as I'll explain. First of all, they need super gifted parents that don't drink the Kool-Aid. And if you're one of them, I applaud you. And if you're thinking about being one of them, I suggest you do. And if this is Chinese to you, if you don't understand what I'm talking about, I suggest you really look into this, because there is no tenable reason why so many people are labeled ADD and bipolar today. It is a nonsense diagnosis. So number one, nutritionally speaking, let's understand we start with the fats. Now we get, and we remember that we've evolved a world here. You hear me harp on these electronic gizmos, these computers, these cell phones, these iPhones, these Androids, the Dells, the Macs, the Apples, the iPods, the microwaves, the heated car seats, and so on and so forth and so on and so forth. Over 20 years, some people say, living in Los Angeles, anywhere in Los Angeles, even in the woods, will be like having a cell phone to your head. Around a city is an electromagnetic cloud. It is ray gun warfare. The war we wage today. The devil exists in electromagnetic radiation that you can't escape unless you're educated. And that over 20 years living in L.A., we will be generating so much. And try getting around without a computer, or functioning without a cell phone, or growing a business without all these electromagnetic amenities. Try doing that. It's impossible. And on that basis, as this complex electromagnetic web increases and intensifies, it hits your baby's head. Your baby's head. Why not everyone? You see the faux pas, my friends of science. The fallacy of science is that if there's two guys sitting in a classroom and they're both exposed to radiation, and one of them has ADD and the other shows no issue with it, the conclusion in science, the defect in science, the default in science, the short-sightedness, the myopia of science is to say, well, it can't be radiation because one guy wasn't affected from it. That is stupidity. That is stupidity with a capital S. We drank the Kool-Aid with this nonsense, again with cigarettes. Two people smoke three packs a day. One of them gets lung cancer, the other one doesn't. And it can't be the cigarette because the other person didn't get it. Yes, this even infests scientific thought. So go to your doctor before he gives your son Ritalin or whatever else these nonsense companies are coming up with, and tell him, could it be the EMF? Some guy, Medici, on a radio show said radiation from my son's cell phone, which he just happens to be on 9 hours a day, and if not that, the computer, just might relate to this attention issue. And you're going to be told that's nonsense because studies don't support it. Studies stink. I'm close enough to high levels of chemistry. I'm responsible at this point, up the ladder enough to tell you you can make anything true with a study, and you can deny anything with a study. It's not a lot different than two guys' opinions at a bar, and yet one guy is right and the other guy is wrong, clear as day. Never do you sacrifice your common sense. Never give up your common sense. If the six-foot man in the great white coat with the Rolls-Royce sitting outside the office tells you something and it doesn't fit your perception of common sense, tell him to his face. In the name of science, this does not make sense. Common sense should prevail at all times. And this is really the scam. Studies and degrees, you're being lied to. You're being told things like, kids today, they're texting all day long. They're on the computer all day long. They're in the classroom on the computer all day long. It was just 100 years ago that we learned our lessons in wood shacks out in the woods near the farm. And 100 years later, you're learning everything off an electronic device that we have multiple perceptions that's harmful. Those rays go into the brain. The brain is pure nerve tissue. It exists on a frequency infinitely higher than the muscles on your body or the organs. Nerve tissue is extremely sensitive. So, what's number two? Get your kid away from EMF. Oh, how are you going to do it? You find a way. You find a way. And if you have to get extreme, you get extreme. Yes. Society needs to get together and admit to itself it's created very unpleasant realities. There's no fertility, and there's rarely or barely an escape from EMF. And there's lots of solutions. It's called get away from it. Do not put a cell phone to your head. If you're driving the car, and of course this isn't for children now, but if you're driving a car, make sure you use the hands-free. There are credible cell phone protectors to be purchased and experienced and experimented with to make sure that the claim, okay, is valid. There's also organizing your day so you take the majority of calls. You see, what all this communication stuff has allowed us to do is to become sloppy in our communication. There's no regulation to our flow then. If you've got to make a phone call, you make it now. You don't say, I'll wait until a certain part of the day, take all my calls, I'll select a part of the day where I can sit down and do that. Now, everything's got to be fast now, because we're going to lose our competitive edge. And that's not necessarily true. Just because you're going faster doesn't mean you're sharper. There's ways around it. And as far as the workforce is concerned, yes. Finally, we've come to the point, before you select a profession, you need to consider your exposure to radiation. Would you work in a nuclear reactor site? Would you tell your son, as a nuclear engineer, that it's healthy to spend the next 20 years of his life on some submarine or nuclear reactor site? Would you do that? No, you wouldn't, because of your knowledge. Occupational hazards have always existed. Radiation is an occupational hazard. And just because it's all around us doesn't mean it's any less of an occupational hazard. So you have choices. You have choices as to where you live. You have choices as to what city you live in. And if you don't have those choices, find other choices. Do not sit back in self-pity and think that you cannot work to get around this. Do not do that, because that's drinking the Kool-Aid. Find a way. That's American. Find a way to solve the problem, even if it's extreme. Now, when I have cases of kids who are extremely in a pickle, or adults, I send them to the woods often enough. It just depends upon how you look at it and what's at stake. If you have a child that's barely functional in school, and you send that child, or you organize your life so that child can be educated out in the country, in the wilderness, if you change that diet off the sugar and into the fat, you're going to watch that child sedate. If you organize its life with a minimum of exposure to radiation. And then there's another one. There's another one that competes with the cell phone. And it's called, competes with the love affair that we have with electronics. And that is, kids don't exercise anymore. Kids used to play ball all day long. When I grew up, I went to school, I came out after school, and I played sports every day for 2, 3, 4, 5 straight hours. I had energy into the night to play more. We don't do that anymore. We sit down in front of a TV. We spend our time texting on the computer, so on and so forth. Exercise, there are genes in the body that we've isolated that have vast influences on our nervous system, on the neurohormonal balance. The sedation of the nerve sensors, that we're not firing those axons too fast, is often very related to exercise. So we have kids that don't exercise. We have kids that are being exposed to massive amounts of radiation. We have kids in love with carbs and sugars instead of fats. We have a whole medical society that's telling us to drink the Kool-Aid. We have an entire pharmaceutical industry with more buying power than U.S. steel, agriculture, and automotive put together, a world consortium of scientists telling us that the best thing you can do when your kid is bipolar is to take the Kool-Aid, eat the drug, and accept the deficit. The odds are way stacked against you standing up. And that's a very simple way to look at why what's happening is happening. Now, a little bit of simple physiology here. Number one, when you start to discharge the drug, if you're on the drug, if you've been on Prozac for years, if you've been on Wellbutrin, if you've been on Zoloft, and you start to come off these things, you have to do it gradually. Because your body cannot do what? It cannot prime the neurotransmitters that you stopped functioning with because the drug took care and took the place of it. So anytime you counsel somebody off these types of drugs, you do it gradually. If you're listening to the show, do not get off these drugs immediately. Come down slowly. And I strongly advise you, before you get to the place where you decide to come off the drug, that what you do is you get your body as healthy as you can get it before you come off the drug, before you even reduce the amount of the drug that you're on. One thing you've got to do is open up the bile ducts. Why? Because as you download that drug out of your body, if you can't get its residues out of the tissue, if you can't change the vibration of the tissue, of the nerve tissue, as you dissociate from the drug, if you can't get that out, you're going to get sick. You're going to get psychotic. You're going to get hurt. So the fundamentals behind coming down off that anti-anxiety, anti depressive drug that you're on are very, very, very important. The bile ducts have to open. The body should be exercising. The person should be, yes, on the fats and off the carbs. The last thing you do is touch the drug. You have to mobilize your assets. You have to gather your resources. And then you begin to come down gradually. Because I know what many people do. They get up one day after some sort of a revelation and they say, I've got to get off this junk. It's making me numb. I don't want to go through the rest of my life simply paralyzed psychically. I want to find out why I'm here and what I'm supposed to do. And so they go cold turkey. And this is a disaster. And so they go from one extreme to the other. Don't do that. Do it little by little by little. And keep in mind this, too. Certain cultures are more likely to require the outdoors. We have on the planet today a large percentage of people who are supposed to be living almost nomadically. We have not adapted many people in the species to the industrial technological state. There's an adaptive process, and the cost of this adaptive process are fertile, elegant, godly minds and spirits. That if you spent thousands of years patrolling the oceans, the Vikings, or inhabiting the forests, the northern Germans, the Welsh, the Scottish, much of African society lived in relation to the wilderness. What about all the South Americans who discoursed in the mountainous Amazonian terrain? These people, the Eskimo, coming here to this great nation against 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years, and coming here to Los Angeles or New York or Washington, how does a Viking, how does someone from Norway with traditions of shipbuilding and being at the ocean live in Kansas? And that's what many of the Scandinavians did. Scandinavians, the Swedish, the Norwegians, and the Danes. Not the Finn. Finland is a different territory. But Norway, Scandinavia, northern Germany, these people lived on the ocean. And so they come here and they settle in Kansas. They settle in Wisconsin. They settle in Illinois. They settle in Indiana. That's where they went, and they started growing wheat. They went from fish people to farmers. They went from fish to corn. That's huge. Why are we overlooking this? It's so simple. 10,000 years of fish, and you're eating corn and wheat, and you're not near the ocean, and you're 6'4" with fiery blue eyes, and you need large waves to calm you down. A good day out there on the ocean, bouncing around, and you're ready for 9 hours of sleep. And now what are you doing? You're working for Mutual of Omaha Insurance Company in some little 6x12 room in an office in Kansas, an upstairs room, staring at a computer all day. And you're on 3 or 4 antidepressants, and nobody can figure out what's wrong. This is what's happening, my friends. Spread this show around, because this is what's happening everywhere. And people are drinking the Kool-Aid. From the medical anthropological standpoint, many of us are nomadic in our basic constitutions. And even if we're not that stereotypical Viking, that northern German, the Teuton, the Saxon, the Celt, even if we don't have that fiber so strong in our constitution, we all came from the soil, and we've had the soil taken away. So on more or less levels, these things are influencing us. And the teeth. Comes down to the teeth again, the bite. Forget the medical anthropology for a moment. The good old bite. If your bite is crooked, if you have its bite is off, if its bite is off, its brain is off. Now, I've done two or three shows explaining this. I had last Sunday, a couple of Sundays ago, January 8th, 40 people in the class, the Medici School. Fantastic. Cheers for us all. First 3 hours of that class on the cranial rhythms and the influence and relationship between a good symmetrical bite and the brain. When the bite is off, the brain is off. If you take a super gifted child, a child that perceives on multiple levels, and it evolves with a crooked bite, it will have a crooked brain. I mean this physically. This is what should be at the forefront of medical diagnosis, that a crooked bite creates a crooked brain. Now, if you put some kid with a crooked bite into a brain that doesn't fire with intensity because it's not gifted that way, then that crooked bite doesn't matter. Sorry, there's not a lot going on anyway. Yes, that's the truth. ADD, bipolar, manic depressive, these people, when you sit and talk with them, they are enormously creative. Now put a crooked bite into a kid like that, and you have an enormously creative kid that can't find a harmonious, fluid presentation, and so its presentation is crooked, and thus what others consider the psychic disorder. Not to mention another little tidbit, when the nostrils are clogged, if the septum's deviated, if for whatever reason the child cannot get air through the nose, fix this. I don't care what it requires, fix it. Because as my class knows from from January 8th, when the air goes through the nose, it pulses the brain. It sedates the nervous system. You cannot calm a child if it cannot get air through its nostrils. There's a reason air is supposed to go through the nose. That needs to be duly respected in the highest levels of medicine. So look at that. Look at the history of psychoanalysis asking you to drink the Kool-Aid. Look at the birth of the super drugs claiming that, well, Mrs. Smith, the chemicals in the brain, and we've isolated these chemicals, Mrs. Smith. We're sure that these chemicals exist in your child because the work of many, many great chemists has proven that your chemicals that you produce is how your brain sees the world, is how you view your world. And these chemicals can be countered by our chemicals. And therefore, you should take the drug. And yet the reality, and here's your common sense, and here's your perspective to this nonsense view. When there is blockage to the creative spirit, the body will produce those very bad chemicals. So they're right and they're wrong. So once again, the pharmaceutical drugs are just a band-aid. They don't get to the real problem. So we've got the history of analysis. We've got these rationalizations for these drugs. We've got kids on sugar, people on sugar, people that don't know how to transform their brain into being fed by good raw fats. We've got all this EMF, all these housing structures that are not resonant with the earth. We've got people coming from tribes that lived out in communion with nature and moved their bodies 3, 4, 5, 6 hours a day. And now they're like bulls in a china closet, sitting somewhere in the middle of nowhere in offices, selling, shuffling papers around for the great corporation that doesn't care whether you live or die or take drugs for the rest of your life. Then we've got people that want to do something about it. Do it gradually. Very gradually. And then last, but certainly not least, the perception that the bite, that a crooked bite will create a crooked brain. The bones of the skull that are supposed to be symmetrical and move in unison. Suppose ADD, bipolar, manic depressive. Suppose you have a child that's been hit in the head. Hit in the head, knocked unconscious, concussions. The fascial lines are twisted and plugged. The first cervical vertebra is not in the right position. The cranial bones can't pulse. The bite can be perfect, and yet the physical offset the flow of the cranium, so the nervous system cannot sedate your child, so your child can't sit still. Amazing. Amazing angle. Commentary. Who is the human race? Can somebody tell me why these things are not self-evident? I can only think that there's an active devil in the world. All the people that have annulled their existence, that have given up the path to their creative abilities in the name of being labeled by people we trust, that still don't get this. Or maybe they don't get it because they don't hear it. So tell your friends, straighttalk.cc. Get on the website. Listen to this show again. Download the show and send it to your friends. This is an epidemic, and it's getting larger, and it's not necessary. And there's nothing about America. There's nothing about good Christian people that should accept this. I'm Vincent Medici. This is Straight Talk on Health. See you next time. An absolute honor. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Straight Talk on Health with Dr. Vincent Medici. Invite your family and friends to the show and learn about Dr. Medici through his website, straighttalk.cc. He'll give you the tools you need to save your health and prevent unnecessary surgeries and harmful drugs. And the best part? You can call in live with your health questions every week. For those of you still holding for Dr. Medici, stay on hold. He'll continue to answer calls for as long as it takes. He's dedicated to your ultimate healing. And remember, to contact his office for an appointment, call Rachel or Johanna at 310-320-1132. That's 310-320-1132. Join Dr. Medici next week at 10 a.m. for more Straight Talk on Health. This show and the information therein has not been evaluated by the FDA, and recommended products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. The information provided on this site is for informational purposes only and is not intended as a substitute for advice from your physician or other healthcare professional.